evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Allison Lurie. Lurie has written many novels, including The War Between the Tates and Foreign Affairs, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1985. Her current novel, Truth and Consequences, was published by Viking in October. Lurie teaches literature, folklore, and writing at Cornell University. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Listen, I want to talk to you about an essay that you wrote in 1982 called No One Asked Me to Write a Novel. You talk about how creativity is encouraged in children only up to a certain age, and then more practical encouragement replaces it, good manners, social success. And then you go on to say that you were encouraged past the usual age because you didn't have much going for you. Do you think that outsider status has helped you as a novelist?
I think a lot of writers feel themselves to be outsiders one way or another. A lot of kids feel that, too. Even the ones whom you think are the in-group don't always feel that they are like they ought to be. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's as rare as we imagine.
Mm-hmm. And then you do think it has helped you as a novelist?
I think it encourages you to do things that are out of the mainstream, yes.
Ah, well, that's an interesting point of view. You know, your novels are often satires on social and academic and literary life. Well, where did you get this satirical idea about life?
I don't know. I must have inherited it from my parents because this was more or less their attitude to the world, particularly my father's attitude.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And where did you come? You were brought up in Chicago, right?
No, I was born in Chicago, but I moved to New York when I was four. So I don't have much memory of Chicago at all.
Oh,
and when I went back there, I didn't really care for it. I didn't feel, oh, this street or this building. I didn't remember it even.
So would your father make up stories about people and give you satirical rundowns of?
I don't think he made up stories. I think he would have. He told stories about things that had happened to him and to people he met. He'd been a social worker, and by the time I came along, he was a social work executive, and he had a lot of stories to tell, and he took this kind of detached, ironic attitude toward everything, and I think I picked that up from him.
Oh, most definitely, most definitely. And you've done a great job with it, I must say. Mm-hmm. You know, in both your novel, The War Between the Tates, and your current Truth and Consequences, the stories take place in a setting called Hopkins County at Cornith University. Now, all of us who live here, you know, we think that you're talking about Ithaca. Do you treat your characters the same way? And are they just slightly disguised?
The setting is only slightly disguised, mm-hmm. but the characters are very carefully planned not to be like anyone I know. In my first novel, I did begin with real people, and I regretted it afterwards.
Oh, a lot of first-time novelists do that.
One of them was hurt. One of them was very pleased. But I decided after that I would always put at least three different real people into the pot when I was making up a character.
Uh-huh. Did you still? But it seems to me, because it feels like it's so close to home, that you might still have people going, Allison Lurie, I knew that. I know that was me in that novel.
The strange thing is that people have done this, but not here in town. But I will hear from people who say, of course you're really writing about Williams, or you're really writing about Wesley, and I know the hero of your book. Because these are, in a way, types of people you would meet in an academic small town. Uh-huh. But I'm very careful now not to point at anyone I know.
Mm-hmm. And so you can convince people, even if they think it might be based on someone, because I kept thinking, I wonder who that is.
Well, people are always telling me they know, but but usually then they'll tell me the name of someone I've never met or heard of.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's talk about Truth and Consequences. It was a wonderful novel, by the way. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
But it's about Jane and Alan McKenzie, and they're a married couple. They're both employed at Cornith University. She's an administrator. He's an architectural historian. He hurts his back, and that changes everything. Tell us more about the story.
Well, I wrote this book because as I got older, I began to notice that many people we knew had chronic illnesses, not the kind of illnesses that cause you to go into the hospital and die, but just nagging, irritating things that stay with you and change your life and change the lives of the people you're close to, sometimes just as much. And I wanted to write about this because I realized that there are many great books about serious illness, about death, about survivors, cancer and tuberculosis back in the 19th century. But there's very little is written about minor illnesses, chronic illnesses. And yet, of course, many more people have them, and they make, in a way, more difference in the world in general than a serious life-threatening illness does, because mm-hmm. there's so many more.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I know, and so many people are on painkillers. And
yeah, people are on painkillers, or people don't do things because they know that it'll hurt if they do, or they won't go somewhere because they can't sit on a plane for more than an hour or so. Their lives changed in ways that often they try to disguise, because you don't want to present yourself to the world as an invalid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as the book goes on, it feels like Alan McKenzie becomes more and more of a dependent, and Jane becomes more and more reluctant and starts feeling like she's just a caregiver.
That's what's happened to them when the book begins. Alan has been ill for well over a year, and gradually they've changed, and she's become the caregiver, and he's become the caregetter. And these are roles that they don't feel comfortable with. They're not happy with. They're trying to be as nice about it as they can, but they're full of resentment, really, that unexpressed resentment and unexpressed anger and fear and all these unfortunate emotions that come into your life when you're in this situation.
Yeah, and it does. It absolutely does change the whole dynamic of the mm-hmm. of the relationship.
That's right. Yeah.
No matter what. And so talk to us about what happens after this.
Luckily, their lives changed. You know, there's kind of a rule in fiction. If a book starts out very upbeat and it starts, let's say, with a happy family having a picnic on a lovely summer day, and the kids are running around and the parents are love each other, then you just know something terrible is on its way. But when a book starts down like mine, you know things are going to get better. And they do, and they get better in unexpected ways. For instance, Alan meets someone who doesn't care anything about the fact that his back hurts, because she's an egotist. She's not interested in other people's pain. She's interested in her own pain. She's got migraine headaches, and she's interested in herself. So because she's a selfish person, she treats Alan as if he were normal, which is something nobody he knows has been doing. And strangely enough, this is good for him, because that's what you want if you're an invalid. You don't want to be treated like an invalid all the time. Mm-hmm. You want to be treated like a normal person. And she does, and that really is good for him.
Mm-hmm. And he's puzzled by it. In some ways.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's puzzled by it, but it also works for him, and it kind of changes his life.
Mm-hmm. And she's, I must say, kind of a diva.
Yes, she is a diva.
And she isn't very sympathetic. I sort of liked her. I've met characters like her, those larger-than-life people.
That's right.
Who really don't care about anybody else, but people are drawn to them.
Well, yes, I think absolute confidence is attractive. On the other hand, as we gradually find out, she has her own fears and anxieties, and she's getting older. She doesn't have a steady job. She doesn't have health insurance. And so even a diva, even a woman who is dominant and charming, can begin to have these anxieties. So she's not completely invulnerable in any way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And no one in the book is.
Yeah, they aren't. Yeah, and Alan's wife Jane takes off with this person's better half or other half or whatever you want to call them. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I don't want to give the story away, but I mean, Jane wants very much to be good, And she wants to be good partly for good reasons and partly because she wants to look good. She wants to think of herself as a good person.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, if you are feeling bad emotions like resentment and impatience and boredom, and you're constantly suppressing these emotions, they're going to get inside and sort of freeze. So she has to learn to accept herself as less than perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then she's able to be happy.
Yeah, yeah. She did think of herself as the good girl.
She wants to be a good girl. Mm-hmm. She doesn't feel that she's got a great deal more going for her. She actually does. She's pretty. She's good at her job. But she doesn't value that maybe as much as she should. What she values is that she is good. And it's difficult to start out wanting to be good. It makes your life harder. And maybe you won't even be as good as you might have otherwise.
Yeah, I do think it's a lot of people's dilemma.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you should be completely selfish. That's terrible, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listen, you also wrote a book about fashion.
Yes.
And what made you want to write that book? People have talked about how it's the book about fashion and history.
Well, it was a lot of fun to do. I mean, I've always been kind of interested in clothes, but I'm not interested in high fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go to New York and buy a designer suit, for instance.
Uh-huh.
But I'm interested in what people choose to wear at different times in their life and different occasions. And I'm interested in what people think that others are saying according to what they're wearing. So I did some reading, and then I did some research. And I'd ask everybody I met and my students, well, if you see a guy wearing a polka dot bow tie, how is he different from a guy wearing a dark striped ordinary tie? And a lot of them said, well, this is a guy with a sense of humor. He's more lighthearted, you know. He's more easygoing. You feel more comfortable with him. And I asked people lots and lots of questions. I asked about handbags. I asked about hats. I asked about colors of clothes. And I discovered, for instance, that we need a lot of jerseys or sweaters in different colors because of different moods. You need a red sweater that's exactly like a gray sweater because some days you feel up and cheerful and you want to be noticed, and other days you want to shrink into the backgrounds. So that's why you need two sweaters. Maybe you need more, a blue sweater, a green sweater, and they all have different messages.
Uh-huh. That's fascinating. Well, what is the name of that book again?
The Language of Clothes.
The Language of Clothes, yeah. I've looked through it and found it fascinating. Hmm. Now that I've met you, I will probably go and read the whole thing.
I hope you like it.
Yeah, I'm interested in what clothes says about people and their moods, and even the different ages wearing different types
that's
of clothes
right.
and
well,
different eras.
For instance, I discovered that men's bathrobes get longer as men get older.
Really?
And you see ads for them. And a young man, especially you can see this on the beach with these terry cloth robes, young guys will be wearing very short robes, and an older man will have one down below his knees. And this is a thing that's been going on for centuries because you see a Shakespeare play in period dress, and the older men, the kings and the noblemen, they're wearing long robes. But the young heroes like Hamlet and Prince Hal, they're wearing short tunics.
Hmm.
And the only exception to this is a Falstaff, who's an old man, but he wears, traditionally on the stage, he wears a short tunic because he refuses to grow up.
Interesting.
And this is kind of a tradition that that's what he wears in the theater. So, I found out lots of things like this, which I never suspected.
Hmm. You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Allison Lurie. Listen, I want to talk to you about what the Pulitzer Prize did to you when you won it in 1985. Did it change you at all?
It brought me more readers. It made it easier for me to sell my next book. It didn't change my life because it came too late. I'd already had my life, or a large section of it. It caused interviewers to always ask me how I felt when I got the Pulitzer Prize. And the answer is surprised and delighted.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't expecting it. And because I think the Pulitzer Prize usually goes to books that seem to be more serious than mine do. I think the only reason this book was eligible was because it's my only book in which I killed off a major character. Mm-hmm. So it was partly a tragedy. I don't think a comedy can win the Pulitzer Prize.
Hmm. Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. Because I was thinking that maybe winning prizes would make you feel like you've reached the peak and you don't really have to try as hard, and or, you know, help you to relax. You don't have to prove as much.
Well, you want to go on trying as hard, because the worst thing that can happen to you is that people say, well, she won the Pulitzer Prize and everything she wrote after that was second rate.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Stopped trying.
No writer wants that. You know, you've segued from novels and written stories and folktales for children. To tell us what the lure is for writing for children.
Why should one write for children?
Why were you particularly interested in doing
that?
Well,
I've never written for children. I've never written an original children's book. I've only written collections of folktales retold from other sources.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think I have it in me to write for children the way the great children's authors have done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but those stories don't come to me.
But you have retold folk tales.
Yes, but that's a lot of fun, because when I was teaching folklore, I came across a lot of stories that I thought should be better known. Mm. And therefore, I collected them and retold them. Originally, my first book of folk tales, I wrote because at that time, there were a lot of articles saying that fairy tales were bad for women, because
Really? They
were all about how you should be good and beautiful and wait for your prince to come. And I knew that this was not true in general. It was true of the few fairy tales that we knew best. And these were the fairy tales that had been selected from thousands of fairy tales in the 19th century by men of letters in Victorian England. And they preferred stories in which women were good and beautiful and passive, because that was the Victorian ideal. So they all picked the story Cinderella.
Mm.
But there's a story called Cinderlad that is just as often told to folklorists running around the country and talking to old women in their cottages. But they didn't pick this story because it said women are strong, women can conquer obstacles, women can rescue a boy who is helpless. You know, so those stories didn't get into the books in mid-Victorian England, and therefore we don't know them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd take some of these stories and retell them in contemporary English and collect them into a book, so to prove that there were other sorts of folk tales, and that was lucky and people bought it, and now everybody mm. knows these stories, and they are some of them in the collections you'll see.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't realized that the history of folk tales were
yeah.
compiled basically by men. Of course, yeah. I should have thought so.
Well, I mean, for instance, it's perfectly true that the Grimm brothers were men.
Oh, yes.
But they were scholars, and they collected over 100 stories. Many of the stories they collected had strong heroines. But those were not the ones when the popularizers came along. Those weren't the ones they chose.
Hmm. You know, it says in one of your biographies that you collect contemporary ghost stories. Do you still?
Well,
I don't
collect ghost stories. I mean, at one time, I was writing a lot of ghost stories, and they were collected into a book called Women and Ghosts.
Yes, and I love
and
that
so
book.
And so at that point, I was asking people for ghost stories because I needed ideas. I haven't done that lately, but maybe I should go back to it. You know,
I did hear some good stories. Yeah, I love that. I generally don't like the short story genre because I want it to continue.
Yes,
and
I
want stories
that.
To be longer. But I did enjoy that, and I've enjoyed a lot of Joyce Carol Oates' collection of short stories as well. I wanted to talk to you about the fact that I've never interviewed or talked to a writer who wasn't also a reader. Who are the authors that you admire and read?
Well, it depends whether I'm writing fiction or not. If I'm writing fiction, I probably won't read much contemporary fiction. I'll save it up because I don't want to be influenced not so much by other people's subject as by their style. So when I'm writing fiction, I'll read 19th century novels or foreign novels, but I won't read the latest book by, let's say, Louise Erdrich or Margaret Atwood. I'll buy them and I'll put them aside and save them for when I'm not writing fiction.
So who are some of the writers that you do read when you're able to do that and you're not writing yourself?
Well, I have books now. I mean, I did just read the latest Louise Erdrich book, which was wonderful. I've just got the new Ian McEwan book. I read a new novel by Julian Barnes, which is about Arthur Conan Doyle, who created Sherlock Holmes. And it's based on a true story in which he took on a case. People used to write to him as if he were Sherlock Holmes, asking him to solve crimes, and mostly he would say, well, I'm sorry, I'm just a writer. But he was touched by this one letter he got, and he went and investigated the crime for which this man had been wrongfully convicted, and he brought in the evidence. He solved it just as Holmes would have, and he got the conviction of this man reversed, and he was released from prison, and it's a wonderful story. I don't think it's quite out in this country yet, but it's a very good book.
You know, I noticed when I was reading Truth and Consequences, and I think probably the ghost stories, sometimes your language does sound British. Do you do that consciously?
I know
you've spent time in
London.
Not
at all, but I think that it's because I was brought up on British children's books and British adult books. You know, my mother had been a high school English teacher, and the house was full of Dickens and Thackeray and the Brontes and Jane Austen, and the children's books I read were mostly English too. At that time, there weren't so many wonderful American writers for children as there are today. So I think that's where it all came from.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I found it compelling because I feel like our language here in the United States is going downhill by leaps and bounds.
I don't know. Your language seems pretty far uphill to me.
But I do hear a lot of bad English.
Yes,
in
I
and
think
around
that's true.
The circles that I wander around in. So you're a teacher of writing. What do you recommend to students who want to aspire to be novelists?
Well, I mostly teach the MFA students, and they're people who've come to Cornell really to find out if they're going to be writers. They're mostly people who've been out in the world for a while after college and had jobs, yet they still think that they want to write. And Cornell will give them 3 years in which they don't have to do a great deal beyond writing. They have to take a couple of courses, but they can choose easy courses. They can even, if they like, they can take a wine tasting or flower arranging. But they have to work seriously on their writing. But they get full support, so they don't have to make a paycheck. They don't have to be in the office from what's called 9 to 5, but more often turns out to be 9 to 6:30 or 7. So it frees them up, and it brings them together with other writers and gives them a chance to see if this is really what they can do and what they want to do.
So you basically critique their
work? Yeah, they meet once a week, and every week we read a couple of stories or chapters from a novel, and people write out their comments, and they talk about them, and the author gets to know how their work is affecting other readers and what people don't understand. And they'll say things like, well, why did she get into the bathtub with all her clothes on? I don't understand that. And then the writer will realize that he or she hasn't explained that. Or they'll say, I want to know more about the nephew. What's he doing in the kitchen? I know. I mean, these are very practical questions. Or they'll, because we talk about technique and we do some writing exercises, they'll realize that everything in their stories is all in black and white, that they never use the word red, yellow, green, blue, you know. It's like they've imagined their story or their novel as a black and white film. And so people will make discoveries about their own writing and be able to expand it through the comments of other writers who are taking it seriously.
And I think a lot of writers who probably just start out forget that what's in their head isn't necessarily going to be conveyed on the page unless they put every detail there.
That's right. Some of them, sometimes there'll be people who put in too many colors. You know, do we really need to know that one of the chairs in the sitting room was striped red and blue and the other one was flowered pink and green? Well, maybe we didn't. In that case, yes, because it shows that whoever furnished that living room has no sense of taste. but sure, they'll discover things, and they'll become friends, and they'll exchange manuscripts even after the class is over. And since it's such a selective program, I would say that about half of our graduates do go on to publish fiction.
Wow.
They publish a novel or a book of short stories.
Oh, that's
and the others, mostly they'll make their living through writing. I was just out in Los Angeles, and I did a reading, and there were five people there who'd been to Cornell, and four of them were screenwriters, and they were people who'd been in my classes.
Wow.
And the fifth was also been in one of my classes, but he was now an entertainment lawyer, and he was much more secure in his work than they were in theirs. That's how it is in Hollywood.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, some of them had won prizes, and they still didn't know where their next production was coming from.
Writing is a perilous, perilous undertaking. Do you go on retreats when you get ready to write a novel, or can you write anywhere?
No, when I had small children at home, I used to go to artist colonies for a few weeks just to get away from all that. But now I don't need to. Where I live, I have plenty of peace and quiet.
And like you wrote, Foreign Affairs was written in about London. Did you write it while you were in London?
No, I didn't. I wrote it mostly when I was in this country.
So just bringing back memories of... I absolutely love London. London is always in my heart. I lived there for a while when I was 18, and then I went back a few times.
Well, that's good. Well, you should keep going back.
It's a wonderful place. Are you working on anything for the future?
Well, right now, I'm just coming to the end of my fall term, and all I've written this fall is a couple of long book reviews. Once I've read the final papers and the grades are in, then I'll try to get back to a project, yes.
We have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us, Alice and Laurie. This has been a great pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.